From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. Andre Brower plays a criminal, and he used to play a cop. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the star of the new TV series Thief. Brower is best known for his Emmy Award-winning work as Detective Frank Pemberton on the police drama Homicide: Life on the Street. He'll tell us why he's gone to the other side. Thief premieres next week on the FX network. Also, the Florida Everglades and the politics of paradise. We talk with Washington Post reporter Michael Grunwald. His new book is about the changing attitudes regarding the river of grass. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. My first guest today is Andre Brouwer, who stars in a new drama series premiering next Tuesday on the FX network. It's called Thief, and Brouwer stars as Nick Atwater, an accomplished thief whose life of crime is a well-hidden secret from his wife and teen stepdaughter. But those two worlds threaten to intersect, as in this scene, when Nick is interrupted mid-robbery by his vibrating cell phone. He and his fellow thieves have just cracked into a walk-in safe, and on the other line, Nick's wife Wanda, played by Dina Meyer, calls with bad news about their daughter Tammy, played by Mae Whitman, and she's calling from a police station.
Damn it.
Come on, let's wrap it up. This is not a good time.
Tell me about it. I'm calling from a police station. I want to talk to Tammy's father.
He's not my father.
You shut up.
What did she do?
Waited outside while some kids broke into the school.
And they're nice. These are her new friends.
Wanda, I can't do this right now.
And I can.
I'm not a father.
Do you want to have this conversation right now? They are standing right here. They want to talk to somebody.
Okay. I'll take care of it. Put him on.
What is that noise?
Wanda, put him on.
Here you go.
This is Officer Milovich. Are you the father?
Stepfather. I'm in a meeting right now, officer. But I want to show you, Tammy has never been in any kind of trouble before.
Brouwer, of course, is best known for playing a cop, not a robber. From 1993 to 1998, he played Detective Frank Pembleton on Homicide: Life on the Street. It was a standout role, and an Emmy-winning role, in a groundbreaking show. Frank Pembleton was a Baltimore detective whose specialty was taking suspects into the interrogation room and getting them to confess. On that show, at that time, Brouwer was the best actor on television. Prior to Homicide, Brouwer was featured in the 1989 movie Glory as one of the Union soldiers in the first all-black fighting unit during the Civil War. He also starred in such TV movies as Murder in Mississippi, The Tuskegee Airmen, and The Court-Martial of Jackie Robinson. In the years during and after Homicide, Andre Brouwer has appeared in several movies, including Primal Fear, City of Angels, and Duets. He'll soon appear as the captain in Poseidon, the remake of the disaster movie The Poseidon Adventure. And between Homicide and Thief, Brouwer starred in two other TV series, the well-received medical drama Gideon's Crossing and the not-so-well-received character drama Hack. I spoke to Andre Brouwer earlier this week. Andre Brouwer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
What do you look for in a script, especially in something that might go to TV series, to make you consider doing it?
Well, you know, I like messy dramas. So when I read the pilot, the question in my mind is there enough of a mess that needs to be cleaned up that will allow this show to live on? So that was true when I read The Sides, basically, when I was doing Homicide. I was intrigued by the character of Pembleton that they had laid out for me. That was true when I did Gideon's Crossing. I said, this is a hell of a mess. I pretty much know from the moment I finish reading the script, I pretty much know whether or not I'm going to do the episode, to be a part of the piece. And that was true with the show that David Morse starred in called Hack down in Philadelphia, and that's true also with Nick Atwater here in Thief.
If you know when it's over, when you finished reading the entire script, that's one thing. When's the first moment in this script, in Thief, where it grabbed you and said, well, no, this is something I really want to keep reading and there might be some gold here? Was there such a moment?
Well, it's somewhere around the time that, in retrospect, I think, it's somewhere around the time where Nick picks up the phone in the vault and has a conversation with Wanda. It's the blending of two different worlds, and Nick has been such a master at keeping these worlds separate. He's been such an accomplished thief and liar and husband, and been able to keep these worlds separate, and now they're starting to blend. And from it, in essence, from the moment that these worlds start to blend, Nick has a decision about being a very wise thief or being a very wise father, and they seem to be mutually incompatible. And what I saw in this pilot was a man who's going to be forced to choose what his loyalties were. Were they loyalties to his nature in terms of being a thief, or were they going to be loyalties in terms of what he hoped to be as a man, which was a good father and a good husband? And because they're seemingly incompatible, the fallout is going to be terrific. And I want to be around to see how he gets out of this one.
You shot the pilot on location in New Orleans in 2004.
Yes.
And then it was picked up much later than most series usually are, almost a year later. And you were just about to start and go back down and do location shooting again in New Orleans, and Katrina hit. What was that like?
Yes.
What was that like?
Well, I was up in Jersey. I was flying down maybe on the 7th of September to start this, and we were on vacation, as a matter of fact, when Katrina struck. At first, I didn't realize how serious the damage was in New Orleans. I thought it was going to be easily contained, but the more I heard and the more I read, I began to realize this is a much, much bigger issue, and that consequently everything had changed right before our very eyes. They immediately began to think about what it was that we were going to do. Filming was suspended. Even the idea of filming was suspended in New Orleans, and we had to start thinking about where we were going to go and what we were going to do. And various locations were bandied about, Los Angeles, Chicago, Vancouver, Toronto, just other places, Atlanta, which we could either move this series to and set it in that locale, or use those locations to as a convincing double for New Orleans. And eventually we settled on Shreveport, which was only 5 hours north of New Orleans. And Shreveport welcomed our production with open arms and were very, very helpful. And we're able to complete the season. Most of the crew, who were all based in New Orleans, made the journey up to Shreveport. Shreveport has, in essence, become the new hub of filmmaking in New Orleans, in Louisiana, and we successfully completed it. I think we have a convincing double for New Orleans. Katrina is a much, much larger story than we could ever possibly contain within Thief, so we folded it in places that we found to be appropriate. But the story of rebuilding New Orleans is much bigger than Thief, and we couldn't do it justice, and so consequently we refer to it in places that I feel are appropriate, without minimizing the wreckage and the damage of Katrina.
Forgive me if this is a sort of naive question, but does the reputation of FX at this point enter into it at all in terms of your deciding to do this series because of it getting well established with S.H.I.E.L.D. and Nip/Tuck and Rescue Me and even Over There, that you can, that it can be a place to do TV, or was it purely based on what was on the script?
It was a consideration. You know, 2 years ago, FX was an upstart, more of an upstart than it is right now. Right now, it's being favorably compared, even though it's basic cable, to HBO in terms of the kind of content that they're willing to put on air. But 2 years ago, that wasn't necessarily true. What intrigued me about the show is their willingness to support a show. They did very good work, and they promoted and supported their shows. And so consequently, I took great comfort in the fact that when they believed in the material and they were willing to stand by their creators as well as the talent who was involved in their shows, then consequently we would get a real shot at going on the air and staying on the air. And that's been important to me ever since Gideon's Crossing, which was a show that I felt was prematurely pulled. And so what was important to me is I want to do a show where I think I can do my best work, but I also want to be in the air next year. And I want to be given an opportunity to do that based upon our merits and the quality of our work rather than short-term consideration.
Andre Brower, star of the new FX series Thief. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking to Andre Brower, a star of the new series Thief, which starts next week on FX. I have some homicide questions. Well, one is, because I remember going down to visit the set at one point, and I was amazed at the method of filming, which was to make you poor actors run through the entire scene from beginning to end with a single camera, shooting it from wherever it was pointing, and then stopping and doing it again a second or a third time. And I guess emotionally it must be more exciting because rather than just doing pickups and close-ups, you're getting to the truth of the scene each time. But I also thought, man, that's heavy lifting. What was that like?
It was fun. It was fun from, it was fun. and I really, really enjoyed my time down there in Baltimore. I felt more like I was on stage than any other piece that I've ever been involved with. When we first started, of course, everything that we were doing, we were pushing the envelope in terms of how we were using the camera and the kinds of stories that we were telling. But subsequently, over the next couple of years, so many people adopted those same techniques that it's now become quite commonplace. But when we first started, it was unheard of to have a 16 millimeter camera sitting on Jean de Sagonzac's shoulder and running through the entire scene from beginning to end. And Tom Fontana wrote long scenes. The one that I think back in particular from our first season was the episode 6 where Bayless, Pembleton, and the Araber are in the box basically for 44 minutes. Moses Gunn and Kyle Secor and myself sitting in the box for 44 minutes, and we would do huge scenes, page after page of dialogue, and then we'd stop and we'd do it from another angle. But in essence, we were doing a play. We were doing a drama in which it was just as dangerous as if we were on stage and it was happening right there before our very eyes. And we got a lot of very interesting, spontaneous human emotion by filming it that way. And I loved it. I absolutely adored it. Now, my subsequent shows have been different from that, but my love of the filmmaking on Homicide has never changed. I'm thrilled with it.
Well, I can tell you that I share your being thrilled with that particular episode, which was called Three Men and Adina.
Right.
And Fontana wrote it, and I have always held it up as one of the best hours of dramatic television I've ever seen written and performed. And it is the other clip that I brought in to play today, a piece from this, because I thought, essentially it boils down to your character of Frank Pembleton and Kyle Secor's character of Tim Bayless as two detectives who have 12 hours to try to flip a prime suspect played by Moses Gunn as the Araber. And so the scene that I want to play is at the very beginning, where basically at this early point in the interrogation, Pembleton is acting very friendly and very loose and very curious and polite. And it's Tim Bayless who's acting impatient and trying to push in and to ask questions about the young girl, Adina Watson, who was killed. So you ready to hear a little bit of this one?
Yes.
Okay, so here we go with Homicide: Life on the Street.
For the record, your name is Risley Tucker?
Yeah.
You live at 2003 Greenmount?
Yeah.
How long have you lived at the present address?
All my life.
Really? No one in the neighborhood calls you Risley, do they? No one calls you Mr. Tucker?
No.
They all call you the Araber.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that term Araber has caused a lot of trouble around here. Two other detectives got into this big argument because one says Araber and the other says Arab. Both grew up in Baltimore, but they have different expressions for it.
Mm-hmm.
I never heard of either not being a native, but it has nothing to do with being an Arab, right? I mean, you don't look Arabic or Arabian.
No.
So what does it mean?
We go from neighborhood to neighborhood selling fruits and vegetables from a cart, a horse-drawn cart.
Mm.
We're like nomads.
How long have you worked as an Arab?
All my life.
How long did you know Adina Watson? You remember the first time that you met her?
Can I? I'm sorry. This Arabic thing, this fascinates me. Moving about the city, selling fruits and vegetables. I'm used to going to a supermarket, a food town or something, you know? Are your prices cheaper?
No.
Then what's the advantage of buying from you? I mean, other than the obvious one, you come to people's front door, people have to get in their car and drive 10 blocks.
Fresher produce.
Well, that's
what did you think about Adina? I mean, Frank and I here, we didn't really know her that well. What would you say about her personality? Was she feisty, outgoing, energetic?
Yeah.
So she worked for you how long? Doing what?
Taking care of Magdalene.
Magdalene?
My horse. Clean out Magdalene's coat with a currycomb, untangling the mane and the tail.
That sounds like a great job for a girl. Why'd she stop working for you?
Horse died.
There's any other reason?
My barn burned down.
That's the only other reason?
I stopped being an Arab.
Any other reason?
There was no more job.
Adina's mother didn't make her stop working for you, huh? Isn't it true that Mrs. Watson was afraid for her daughter because you were getting a little too friendly with her?
Huh? Is being an Arab a good job? I mean, are you respected in the community?
Most people think of us as vagrants. But since the economy gone sour, you see a lot of people selling on the street.
Your whole family Arabs?
You know, we had a sort of an argument beforehand about where to cut off this clip, and we couldn't
never stopped.
We couldn't cut off the clip. It was just too good. It's not only great television, but it's great radio. What are your memories of filming that episode?
Well, we had, I don't know, 14 pages a day to do. My most visceral memory was we would leave the set and I would go home and I would sit down and I'd learn 14 pages of dialogue a day. But I do have to say more, Moses Gunn really turned into a very sweet performance in my mind, because it's never definitive whether or not that he had anything to do with Adina Watson's murder. But at the very end of the show, he says, you know, why should I be proud? Why should, you know, he's crying, he's weeping. He says, why should I be proud? Why should I be happy when I'm forced to admit that the greatest love of my life was an 11-year-old girl? And nothing's definitive by saying that she's the great love of his life. But what I begin to realize is that, once again, the great pathos of this episode comes from the fact that we begin to really actually realize that Risley Tucker loved this girl. And we're talking fictionally, of course, because mm-hmm. in real life we have no evidence to that effect. But this is part of Tom Fontana's genius, is that we are never quite certain as to what it is that we have on our hands, because evidence may point in one way and our feelings about the Arab may point in a certain direction. But Tom's genius is that he's written a man who's fully dimensional. So consequently, there is a tremendous amount of heartbreak and sadness on his part because Adina's no longer alive. But what I also think is interesting about what Tom did in this episode is that I came in firmly convinced that the Araber was not the man, as a prime suspect, that this was absolutely boneheaded, and that the rookie had gone out on a limb. And by the end, Pembleton feels quite certain that the Araber is the man. Is the man, and Bayless is not so certain at all, you know, based upon the same interview and the same information that we gained. So I really enjoyed working on this piece with Tom. Tom's written some dynamite episodes over the years, as has Jim Yashimura. Jim and Tom worked very closely together during those years, and I have to say they really turned in some spectacular episodes. Tom wrote the episode where Pembleton has a stroke. He wrote it over the weekend. He called me up and he said, because I had said to him, basically, I think we've played all the stories with this Pembleton character, and maybe it's time for me to move on. And he says, well, no, I don't think so. He says, let me put my thinking cap on. So he came back and he said, he called me on the phone. Maybe it was Thursday he called me on the phone. He says, you know, Andre, I think I'd like to give your character a stroke. And I said, huh, that sounds really interesting. I said, it really sounds interesting. Let me run it by my boss. So I spoke with Amy, and Amy's an actress also.
Amy,
and she
your
understands,
wife, yes.
Amy, my wife. And yeah. She understands how challenging and meaty this would happen. And I said to Tom, my only condition is that I not – immediately recover and have a spunky therapist that I grow to love and all of the cliches that come with rehabilitation. I said, I would like to do some research so that I could, we can tell these stories in a much more, I think, truthful manner. So during that summer, the summer of 1996, between seasons, I went to the Rusk Institute in New York City to learn about stroke and the rehabilitation from stroke. I was doing Henry V out in the park by night and over at the Rusk Institute for rehabilitation by day. And for me, the aftermath of the stroke, it was not so much about the rehabilitation, but how fundamentally changed all of all of our relationships were by the fact of Pembleton's stroke. So his marriage is falling apart because he is absolutely obsessive about getting back on the force because he considers what he does to be vastly more important than holding his wife's hand or raising his daughter or anything. He actually rather would be standing over a dead body cracking jokes with his pals mm-hmm. in the middle of the night than he would rather be doing anything. So his marriage suffers terribly by the fact that he'll do anything to get back on the force, including not taking his medication that so that he can pass the gun test. And whereas he was once the grizzled veteran and Bayless was the rookie, the power has changed absolutely in the relationship. And in a certain way, we flip places. So at one time, Pembleton was first among equals, and now he's a much more humble man.
Andre Brower, star of the new FX series Thief, which premieres next Tuesday. We'll conclude our talk in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. From Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD available at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Into the Blue, a novel of psychological suspense set in Britain by Robert Goddard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, alligators, orchids, and lots of grass. We'll talk with Washington Post reporter Michael Grunwald about his new book, The Swamp. He'll tell us about the opposing forces of conservation and destruction in the Florida Everglades. Also, more with actor Andre Brower. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're talking with Andre Brower, star of the new drama series Thief, which starts next Tuesday on the FX network. He's also starred in the TV series Homicide: Life on the Street, Hack, and Gideon's Crossing. But when he started as an actor, his earliest experiences were in the theater. You had a long career in television, even predating Homicide. And mm-hmm. If I have your early career right, where you came to acting fairly late at Stanford, I don't know if you finished all of your degrees and were out of Juilliard before you began acting professionally, or if you were juggling the two. But
I came to acting, I guess I was 20 years old, somewhere in my sophomore year. I changed my major at Stanford University. So I graduated with a BA in drama in 84.
Mm-hmm.
And graduated from Juilliard 4 years later in 88. And then my first movie experience was Glory in 1989. We came out the Christmas of 89. And I did a little bit of television and a lot of stage before that movie broke, which began to create a reputation, I think, as a moral force, mm-hmm. a moral reputation as an actor. And I've done a variety of feature films, but television has always been my mainstay, and I enjoy television, so it works out.
Well, let's talk about two of those very early things. I mean, with Glory, you mm-hmm. were right there with Denzel Washington, who was just off of or still in St. Elsewhere, and Morgan Freeman and Matthew Broderick, and a very ambitious movie. And then the first thing I saw you on television was on the remake of Kojak with Telly Savalas. You know, and I'm sorry, I've been a TV critic for a long time. And
wow.
And I don't know if you're exhausted from answering Kojak questions, but I have one for you.
Okay.
You're doing Glory, you know, yeah. You're out of Juilliard, you're out of Stanford, and you're doing Kojak. What was that like?
It was a tremendous opportunity, and I think I was wise to be involved with it. It was my first experience with television. We were doing two-hour movies of the week, and I said to myself, you know, this is, I think, the right thing to do. It was one of the golden opportunities. Oddly enough, it was one of the golden opportunities that I was wise enough to actually go ahead and pick up. And so I look back and say, yeah, that turned out good. So I guess we did five or six of those little television movies, but I really enjoyed it and really introduced me to the craft of television acting. Acting is acting wherever you go, but there's certain things that you need to know about the pace of television work. And so so I was happy to be a part of that.
When you talk about acting on television and learning how to act on television, what did you learn from Kojak, from those early TV movies, that you needed to learn to be a better TV actor?
That the terrific pace of television demanded a tremendous amount of preparation in before I even stepped foot on the set. So I knew from that moment that I needed to be superbly well prepared if I was going to be able to be a success at this. The pace that we used on Kojak was so accelerated that if it was good for the camera, it was good. On many occasions, everything was one take, maybe two.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, it resembled almost watching, you know, daytime drama. It was very, very camera oriented. And I knew that in order to be successful at that, I would have to be very well prepared. So that the necessity of creating for myself a compelling and specific backstory, as well as knowing my lines in intimate detail and all of their import, meant that if I discovered anything on set, that I had a foundation to deal with it. And that served me well in television. The pace has always been accelerated. For example, when we did when we came down to Shreveport to do the remaining five episodes of Thief this season, we mm-hmm. had 5 days of rehearsal. Well, 5 days of rehearsal is an incredible luxury on television, and I made the most of that by making sure, in a certain way, while we were in rehearsal, to find out what was at the bottom of these scenes to the best of my ability, so that when the time came on set, I had already dealt with and discarded all of the choices that I felt were wrong, you know, so that the stuff that I was doing on set was much more of what I thought was the essence of Nick's character. I left a lot of bad choices in the rehearsal room, and for me, that was essential to reaching the next step with this character.
Well, your performances on television have been so much fun for me to watch over the years. So thanks very much. Thanks for being here on Fresh Air, Andre.
My pleasure.
Andre Brower. His new series, Thief, premieres on the FX network next Tuesday. Coming up, the life and slow death of the Florida Everglades. This is Fresh Air. Michael Grunwald's book, The Swamp, The Everglades, Florida, and the Politics of Paradise, came out of newspaper series he wrote as a reporter for The Washington Post, on the Everglades and on the Army Corps of Engineers. According to Grunwald, pretty much anyone in South Florida who's living west of I-95, the north-south highway running only a few miles from the East Coast, lives on land that once was part of the former Everglades. That's several million people living in a place that early explorers once compared unfavorably to hell. The Swamp explains the unique ecosystem of the Everglades. It recounts all the wars fought between natives and would-be settlers over the vast wetlands, and all the industrial-era efforts to tame, drain, and develop the river of grass known as the Everglades. The book begins with the passage of the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, a multi-billion-dollar environmental cleanup bill passed by Congress 6 years ago. The bill hands the work of saving what's left of the Everglades to the Army Corps of Engineers, the same group that became famous and infamous in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. Describe the Everglades to people who have never been there, both the basic boundaries of it and what you're likely to find inside there.
You know, I always like to say about the Everglades that it's kind of less ooh and ah than hmm. You know, it's not the Grand Canyon and it's not Yellowstone National Park. And the guidebooks, they're still always warning tourists. They have these great euphemisms. They say the Everglades takes some getting used to, or it reveals its secrets slowly. You know, its appeal may escape many visitors at first glance, which is a kind of kind way of saying that you're not going to see, you know, giant mountains and rugged cliffs and you know, craters and geysers. It looks like a meadow or a very wet and wet tundra. It's essentially a river of grass. It's the slowest moving and widest river in the world, and it flows essentially from Lake Okeechobee, or it did in its natural state, which is in the center of peninsula, all the way down to Florida Bay and the 10,000 Islands. And it was just this broad sheet of gently flowing water going through the sawgrass. It could look kind of monotonous. It had these sort of teardrop-shaped islands with trees on it and had plenty of wildflowers. And it had royal palms and panthers and gators and otters. It's the only place on Earth where you'll find crocodiles and alligators side by side. But essentially, it was water and it was grass. But it is at first glance, you wouldn't necessarily say this was this is a national park. You see plenty of tourists out there saying, like, is this it?
Michael, this book grew out of a series that you did for The Washington Post, which grew out of a previous series that you had done for The Washington Post on the Army Corps of Engineers. At what point did you visit the Everglades for the first time?
You know, I went in August 2000. I was writing a series about the Army Corps and investigating how they were cooking the books of their economic studies in order to justify boondoggles that usually had really serious environmental consequences. Mm-hmm. And I had heard that, you know, the Corps had helped to destroy the Everglades, and now the Corps was in charge of this great project to restore it. So I thought that might be a nice way to cap the series, to write about the possible future of this agency that in the past was better known for dams and dikes and dredges. So I went in August 2000, and it was hot. There were bugs. it was wet and nasty.
I can say as a former resident of Florida that August in Florida is no paradise by any means.
You know, but I did start to, you know, I had some very good tour guides who explained to me, you know, kind of how the Everglades works, which is, you know, one of the really cool things about it. When you start to see, gosh, you know, there are all these species that don't seem to belong on the same continent, much less the same ecosystem. You know, how can a panther and a hammerhead shark be in the same place? What I also started to realize was that this restoration project was a lot more complicated than I had thought. In Washington, it had just been sold to us as kind of like, hurrah, we're saving the Everglades, so let's all sing kumbaya. But in fact, this $8 billion, now up to nearly $11 billion project, is much more complicated. It's a water supply project that's supposed to provide water for another 6 million people to move to South Florida, mm-hmm. For the sugar industry, for real estate. And it's supposed to provide some for the Everglades, too. But what I found is that the benefits for economic interests are really swift and sure in this project, but the benefits for the Everglades were delayed for decades and highly uncertain. And in fact, you know, I came back a couple of years later and decided to do an entire project, entire series for the Post that was just on this restoration project.
Mm-hmm. The Swamp, the Everglades, Florida, and the Politics of Paradise is the title of your book, and it sort of gives the various chunks of the book. There's the history of the state in geographic and geological and biographical terms. And then there's all of the wars between European settlers and natives. And then when American colonialists came in and the whole claim for the state, and then once the state is established, there's the development and exploitation of the state. And then after environmental disaster after disaster, then opportunities and chances to try and reclaim it. And at every single stage, there's politics and there's people and there's all sorts of amazing characters. And I don't know, as you went around researching the various chunks of this, which one surprised you the most, and which one was hardest to wrestle to the ground?
Well, thank you so much for your kind words. I mean, I really did. I saw this as a story. It's a very important story, I think. I think the Everglades is kind of the ultimate test of sustainable development. But most of all, I was really drawn to it because it's such a gripping story. You know, the Everglades was really America's last frontier. And you know, I didn't realize that in 1880, the census for Dade County, which at that point was most of South Florida, the equivalent of about 5 million people today, it was 257. So that was one of the real surprising things, was tracking the transformation of the frontier. I mean, you know, frontier stories, that's where the action is. I was also really shocked by, you know, that we all have a sense that kind of, you know, man's relationship with nature has changed, that we used to think about taming nature and now we want to work more in harmony with nature. But I had no idea that it was the conservationists who were the most aggressive about taming nature. The drainage of the Everglades, which has had such disastrous environmental consequences, was a conservation project when it was first started. My favorite character in the book is Governor Napoleon Bonaparte Broward. You hear about Broward County. Well, this was a guy who was as colorful as his name. He had a crazy Horatio Alger childhood, later became a gun runner for Cuban revolutionaries, and then became governor of Florida by running on a platform where his top priority was to save the Everglades.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, he didn't mean to save it from drainage or development. He meant to save it from oblivion. He was a conservationist, a guy who wanted to protect fish, protect birds, and turn this great wasteland, which is what wetlands were considered in those days, into really productive land, something that people could use. That was really what conservationism was all about. It was the opposite of waste, the wise use of natural resources. You know, everybody remembers, particularly in Florida, where people seem to multiply a lot, that, you know, God told us to be fruitful and multiply, but they forget the rest of the quote, which is, and replenish the earth and subdue it and take dominion over the fish of the sea and the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. So back then, exploiting nature was not just man's right. It was man's duty. It was God's work. And that was something I didn't understand before I buried myself in the archives.
One of the things that's most striking about your history, because you stop being a reporter and start being a historian when you put it between hard covers, is that you are sort of forgiving of a lot of different sides and a lot of different political viewpoints in different eras, that, you know, you sort of accept manifest destiny. You sort of accept the various driving forces that were accepted at the time. And was that an original approach that you took from square one, or was it when you were collecting everything and trying to make sense of it?
Well, as I got to know these characters, you know, it was different from journalism, where when I'm reporting a story for The Washington Post, I'm talking to people who are living in the same era as I am. But as I was, you know, reporting on somebody like Napoleon Bonaparte Broward or Henry Flagler or someone from another era, I started to feel that it was really unfair to judge them by the standards of our day, that I really had to put them in context. You know, you take somebody like John Gifford, who was the great Florida conservationist of the early 1900s. He was actually the editor of a national magazine called Conservation. And he called the Everglades Drainage Project the greatest conservation project of its day. Mm-hmm. And he imported these seeds from Australia of a tree called Melaleuca, which he thought would be a natural swamp tree because it was a very thirsty tree and it kind of sucks the wet right out of wetlands. And he planted a few over by Biscayne Bay and a little bit by the town of Davie. And today, 100 years later, there are 1 million acres of Melaleuca in the Everglades. It is a weed. It is, you know, everybody hates it.
Yeah.
But John Gifford didn't know that. You know, he was trying to help. So I try not to be too judgmental about guys like that.
Talk a little bit about the history of the draining of the Everglades, the very first time that people went in and wanted to claim the bottom half of Florida and use it for their own purposes.
Well, it originally was supposed to begin, right in the 1840s, and there was a guy named David Levy Yulee who had sort of led Florida into statehood with this great socialist vision of a railroad, state-owned railroad across the state. But it turned out he decided once he got power that a better idea would be a Yulee-owned railroad across the state, and instead of Florida spending the next couple of decades focusing on draining the Everglades, state government ended up spending up most of its time promoting David Yulee's railroad, which ended up being a really great thing for the Everglades. It preserved it for another generation. Then in the 1880s, a Yankee industrialist named Hamilton Diston, he had inherited a factory from his dad, and he really wanted to get out of his dad's shadow, came down to Florida on a fishing trip. And he saw what so many others saw, this deep black soil, this gorgeous climate, this bountiful rain. You know, all you had to do was just get rid of that water, just drain it off. And, you know, water runs downhill. So he thought that would be a piece of cake. But 15 years later, he didn't really get the job done. Henry Flagler, the great developer who he was John Rockefeller's partner at Standard Oil, he considered draining the Everglades, and this guy had the money to do it. He was one of the richest men of his era. But at the last minute, he decided that he was going to focus instead on his railroads and hotels, and he ultimately built a railroad all the way to Key West through the ocean. And he was willing to do that. He spent the equivalent of $500 million on it, but he fortunately didn't turn his considerable energies to draining the Everglades. And then finally, Napoleon Bonaparte Broward really got the program going in the early 1900s. He was a great conservationist, a progressive, and drainage was the hallmark of progress. He thought he could save the Everglades by, not from drainage and development, but from oblivion.
Michael Grunwald, author of The Swamp, The Everglades, Florida, and the Politics of Paradise. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
We're talking with Michael Grunwald, author of The Swamp, The Everglades, Florida, and The Politics of Paradise. Let's talk about the politics of paradise for a minute here. as Florida develops, as various interests want to get down there with railroads and for sugarcane and for everything else, talk about how important it is, some of the other things that were going on in the country that affected Florida. You mentioned specifically the National Park Service when it was established in 1916, and things that you would think at first blush wouldn't have a lot to do with the Everglades, but turned out to be crucial.
Well, Everglades National Park was started in 1947. It was the first national park established for biology rather than just its scenery. And it really represented an understanding that you couldn't just, it was one thing to sort of stop hunters from killing birds or stop fishers from overfishing, that you really had to protect a sense of place. And that led, but of course at the same time, the Army Corps of Engineers was getting going with its Central and Southern Florida project, which has contributed so much to the decline of the Everglades. Though at the time, again, conservationists saw no conflict between the two whatsoever. There wasn't that kind of understanding that the things that happen outside the borders of a national park can affect what goes on inside. Because the Everglades is essentially a water park. What made the Everglades work was water. Used to flow, the ecosystem really began in Orlando, what's now Orlando, and flowed all the way down to the coral reefs off the Keys. And the lifeblood was this clean, fresh, gently flowing water. And, the story of the last 100 years is how we've dammed and diked and diverted that water and how we've developed half of the Everglades. Today, half of it's gone and the other half is an ecological mess.
So if clean water is so important to the Everglades, you have the Clean Water Act of 1972. Is that a big tipping point or a turning point in the history of the Glades?
Well, the late 60s and early 70s are a really important time because there was this sort of national awakening to this notion that we were essentially fouling our own nests. This was a time when that river caught fire in Cleveland. The
yes.
Bald eagle, the symbol of America, almost went extinct. And there was this kind of understanding that, you don't have to be this kind of eco-freak to care about, the air that we breathe, the water we drink, the landscapes we like, the fisheries that feed us. And, that's been in Florida, there's been a real sense that the development of the Everglades has continued, there have been terrible impacts for people. I mean, first with Broward's canals, in the dry season, they carried out the water and pretty soon the swamp was on fire. You had the very muck soil that had attracted these settlers to the Everglades in the first place was drying up and blowing away. The drinking wells that, the aquifers for most of South Florida sit right underneath the Everglades and they had terrible saltwater intrusion. And now in modern times, you're starting to see an extension of that, that as we've sprawled into the Everglades, not only are you losing the ecotourism industries and the fisheries and, the diving over by the Keys, but that you're also, you're finding Floridians are spending their time sitting in traffic, that their schools are overcrowded. In Broward County, kids have to start lining up for lunch at 9:50 in the morning. That Florida kind of began to lose its sense of place, that the things that made Florida, Florida were gone and that this wasn't the reason people had moved there. So that really is what has created, to the extent there's been a political backlash against the destruction of the Everglades. It's as we've realized that what hurts the bugs and bunnies isn't always good for us.
In the 6 years since the $8 million comprehensive Everglades restoration plan was passed, what was that supposed to do, and how much of it has it done so far?
Well, it's essentially supposed to restore some semblance of the natural Everglades. And obviously, you can't entirely restore it. That would be like restoring the omelet you ate for breakfast to its egg. there's a lot you can do to try to recreate that flow. What they're always talking about is getting the water right. Get it in the right amounts and the right places with the right quality and at the right timing. And unfortunately, the news the last few years has not been very good. In fact, I write about this one Army Corps memo where the guy overseeing the project in Washington says, we're only 5 years in. We're already way behind schedule, over budget, and this isn't restoration at all.
And since the book has been published, are you keeping tracks on it, like checking in on a critically ill patient to see how the Glades are doing?
Absolutely. And I think it is a quagmire. You're kind of stuck for life. You know, I really think that, this restoration project is hugely important, not just for Florida, but really for the world. I mean, South Florida is where we're going to figure out whether man can live in harmony with nature. And this project is being watched in the Chesapeake Bay, the Great Lakes, Louisiana's coastal wetlands. I spoke to the guy who's in charge of trying to restore the Garden of Eden marshes that Saddam Hussein destroyed in southern Iraq. And he says he's paying careful attention to what goes on in the Everglades, that's a model for him. The Everglades, where you've got this unbelievable political support all across the spectrum. You've got the world's most beloved wetland, the world's most intensely studied wetland. You've got, plenty of rain, and you've got plenty of science, not to mention plenty of money. You really have to wonder, if you can't save the Everglades and its ecosystem, what are you going to save?
All right. Well, Michael, thank you very much. Thanks for coming on Fresh Air.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
Michael Grunwald, reporter for The Washington Post. His book is The Swamp, The Everglades, Florida, and the Politics of Paradise. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Count of Monte Cristo, introduced by Luke Sant, available in stores and online. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at macfound.org. And from Walmart, working with its customers throughout the month of March to help America's second harvest in the fight against hunger here at home at secondharvest.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with filmmaker Noah Baumbach. His Oscar-nominated movie, The Squid and the Whale, is out now on DVD. It's an autobiographical look at a family torn apart by divorce. Join us for the next Fresh Air.